Right, so good evening. So tonight I'd like to speak about the wanting mind, the mind of desire, of craving, of leaning into the moment, or also leaning away from the moment. This is one of the critical aspects of Dharma practice that we need to understand and to see for ourselves how this leaning into the moment shows up, just in day-to-day life, but also goes into some of the deepest teachings of the Buddha, some of the deepest reasons why we continue to suffer. So it's really more than a pattern. It's this central aspect, wanting something to begin, wanting something not to end, to keep continuing, wanting something not to happen, wanting something to end. The sense of wanting the moment to be something other than it is. As you reflect on that quality of wanting, how much of our time, our energy is spent in that? How much of our actions are based on trying to move our wants along? Really, our society, our culture conditions us to swim in this sea of wanting. It's like we were born and raised in this. This is how we see the world. It becomes part of the fabric of how we are as human beings, how we show up in the world. And so to go against that is asking quite a lot, is asking us to go against this strong current of wanting that forms the basis of many parts of our society. Because everyone else around us is going the other way, is going with the current. In One Dharma by Joseph Goldstein, he wrote, "Even someone as remarkable as His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, speaks of the strong force of desire in the mind. He told one story at a conference in Los Angeles. Every day on the way to the conference, he was driven down a street with shops selling the newest technological toys. As you know, he has a great interest in the latest technologies. On the last day of the conference, he was recounted what had been going on in his mind as he was being driven past these stores. He said that by the end of the week, he found himself wanting some of these things, even though he didn't even know what they were." And this is the quality of wanting. It's like we just kind of get this allure towards something, toward this shiny object. Now, this also forms the core of the Buddha's teachings. Around much of the core concerns this quality of wanting. It shows up in several forms and expressions, including some of the deepest teachings. And to start to get a handle on this process of wanting, we use our old tool of mindfulness, of direct knowing. Now, an essential part of this mindfulness is this steadiness of attention, the ability to hold our attention without wavering, without becoming distracted. So a central part of this, to cultivate this, is coming back again and again, like to our breath, to our experience of our breath, our body, whatever's arising in this moment. So much of our early practice is learning to keep doing that, to have our attention become more and more steady. And it takes a significant amount of practice and perseverance for that to happen. But once our attention is steady, once it has that ability to stay more or less focused, we start to shift from being this unconscious participant in wanting. Usually wanting just drives us. It's like we're a dog. It's like when we first got our dog, he wasn't very a good leash walker. So he'd be pulling me along, and this one man said, "Who's walking who, the dog or you?" So that sense of being pulled along by our desires, by our wants. Until we're conscious of that, we're an active participant. As we start to, our mindfulness starts to have enough steadiness to actually rest on this quality of wanting, we can start to see this whole process. Instead of being an unconscious participant, we can start to become a conscious observer, to actually be observing it and knowing what we're seeing, how this process is being felt without being caught in it. It's almost like you're stepping out. Instead of being in this ballroom with everybody dancing around, you go up on the top floor and you can look down and see all the dancers moving around, seeing all the process. Eventually it transforms into being a conscious participant, that we're still actively in life, in what's happening, but we're conscious of it. Craving arises, we see it, wanting arises, we see it. And because we see it, we have a choice of whether to participate, to follow through with it, or to simply observe it, or to release it. It's like with the breath. Often, beginners, when we start to practice, we ask them just to watch their breath. And inevitably, someone has trouble with letting the breath be just as it is. They start to put their attention to it, and they start to control it right away, making it long or short. So it takes a while to have this quality of mindfulness that sees without influencing, without altering. So then the breath can just be breathing itself, and you're just watching that. And that translates into watching the body sensations. Even thoughts can arise without us having to engage and add to them. Even the sense of self can be observed as that arises and passes away without becoming a participant in that, without believing in it. So same too with this quality of wanting. So this quality of observing wanting is very critical. In one of the Buddha's early suttas anyway, his talks, he talked about the fire sutta. He said the whole world is on fire. The eye is on fire, the nose is on fire, the ear is on fire. All the senses are on fire. With fire of what? Of wanting, of craving. So everywhere that we look, we see, we hear, we touch, we taste, we think, there's this quality of wanting it or not wanting it. And in that quality of that, it's like a fiery quality that really contributes and maintains suffering. So we start to work with this mind state or this inclination of ourselves. It's good to start where it's not so gripping, where it's not so all-consuming. Because when wanting becomes so gripping, again, wanting or not wanting, we can see them at the same side, same coin with different sides. When we're so gripped by it, our whole world becomes shaped by that wanting. The very way we perceive life, the way we perceive ourselves and others is colored, changed, shaped by wanting. It just becomes all-consuming. The very sense of who we are is affected by that. It takes shape in order to want. So it's very hard to distinguish that. In fact, the wanting itself creates the sense of self in that moment. So there's times that it's very strong, very gripping, when it's like, it feels like your life depends on having this or not having this. You know, those are very difficult times to practice until we've developed confidence in our own practice, our ability to see clearly, to actually not be so caught in it. So finding a mild wanting, a wanting that's has enough energy behind it that you can follow it for a while, but not so much that it sweeps you off your feet. So if you're observing wanting, it's like starting to see it as a process instead of as something to obtain, something to get rid of. But what's the actual process of wanting? Seeing the story behind it, the premise, the promises that come up around that, with the thing that you want, the promise that it gives you, the energy of it. You know, being curious, as the homework encourages to see, what does it feel like to really want in the body, in the mind? And as the attention becomes more subtle, you can start to get a sense of the positionality that you assume in relationship to what you want. So seeing the position of how you take shape. It's like if you have something that you want, there's a sense of, okay, I would be much better if I have this. Okay, so we so much focus on the object and how to get it. But if you notice that actually the sense of reaching and the sense of me being separate from that, or something I want to get rid of, that sense of trying to push it away, there's a certain positionality that you pour yourself into, that you take form into, you take birth into. So becoming familiar with this quality of wanting, when it's easy to work with, when it's doable, it's very helpful because you can start to recognize that same process in more subtle ways and also in more gripping ways. It's like, oh, this is wanting, when I'm really caught, when I really want something. You know, our culture is so much based on wanting. It's almost how the economy works. Advertisements, you know, if you want this thing, you know, wanting this experience, this shiny object, they help you imagine how wonderful it would be to have this, to own this, this experience or this object, you know, the smell of it, the experience of it, to hold it, to feel it. Or maybe the advertisement focuses on how having this experience or this object will help you forget and escape what you don't want about yourself. Maybe being bored, being out of touch, being lonely and unhappy. It's very illuminating to watch advertisements from that standpoint, how they really focus, they really go into this quality of wanting, and they know how to trigger it and how to entice it in you, how to stimulate it, how to drive you. So look closer at the ads. Look how the actors seem. Have you ever seen an actor that doesn't look happy in an ad? There's a sense that everything they have things together. They're healthy, beautiful, youthful. And those two can be yours if you just buy their product. You know, maybe there's a sense of wanting to escape from the unhappiness of yourself. So you look at a simple ad, it's not only the sense of wanting, it really ties in to the sense of you that will be formed by that wanting. It's also interesting that it never quite works. It's like trying to fill a colander, you know, with all the holes in it. It keeps leaking. You keep pouring more and more water, grasping after more things. It never quite fills up. So this is much of our society, much of our culture. As going to the holiday season, it's contrasted that with Thanksgiving, which is almost like a non-holiday because it's hard to put a lot of commercialness into it. You know, it's like, but Christmas has such a strong quality of wanting, of giving and getting. And spirituality is not exempt from that. When you start to get a sense of this pattern of wanting, you see it coming up in the middle of a meditation. Oh, I wish that bell would ring, that moving into that moment. Or when the mind is very settled and there's that quality of deep peace and calm, that wanting that. You see it on retreats when people who you've sat before, they come in and they say, oh, I want the last retreat, this retreat to be like the last retreat. There's that leaning into the past, how it was. We were, over the holidays, we were watching some movies in the theater. And there's this advertisement, you know, before the previews of this cell phone. And so it started off showing, you know, how wonderful a smartphone was. But that was really wonderful 10 years ago. And now it's kind of, you know, it's kind of boring, it's kind of dull, it's kind of lost its luster. So they show the actors being kind of depressed. You know, so it's interesting, in the ad they're actually showing the thing that was so enticing, now it's lost that luster. But the good news is they have something else, all right? And if you get this new product, which projects it out on the wall or has a big speaker on it, and the actors were so happy and so exciting and so vibrant, if you just have this. And you can see how the sense of self, it's like, if I can just have that, this possession. So it really moves from wanting is really a promise to try to have a certain sense of birth, a certain sense of self take birth in relationship to that object or that experience. That's very important to see that. And you can see it constantly through the day. Probably hundreds of times during the day, you're taking birth in different forms. This is not an abstract thing. It's something that you can see for yourself. And you start to become curious about it, you start to explore it, you see how it arises and passes away. Now if you look at this quality of wanting, it shows up in at least four places in the suttas, just in a quick glance at them. I'm using wanting as this umbrella term to cover different aspects of the Buddha's teaching. It shows up in the hindrances, which I've spoken about with the worry mind, the sense of craving and aversion in particular, that movement towards something, the movement away from something. And how this, when hindrances are present, they distort how we see. Our sense of seeing reality is shaped by that hindrance. Also, it has a quality making the mind less pliable, but more brittle, because it gets so caught up in this object of disliking or this object of desire. Right? So the hindrance expression of this pattern. It also shows up in the Four Noble Truths, some of the foundational reasons why we practice that makes this Dharma practice. And the quality of that there is suffering, there is this expression of unsatisfactoriness. There is a origination of that, which is craving, is wanting, tanha. There's the end of that craving, and there's a path to the end of that craving. So if you look at that second noble truth, this truth of the origination or the cause of suffering, is this quality of wanting, this quality of movement. Right? So that's how critical this understanding, this quality of wanting is to our practice, to our freedom, to the end of our suffering. And the Buddha talked about three types of this type of craving, the sense of wanting. The craving for sense pleasure, which we've kind of been exploring, that sense of, you know, wanting this experience. You can think of it also as not wanting a particular sense experience, pushing it away. There's also this craving to be and to not be. To be and not to be. This quality of wanting to be a certain person, to have a certain sense of identity, have a sense of role, self-image, thinking back to those happy actors. They're so, everything's together, everything's going well in their life. That sense of leaning into wanting to be a certain way. Flip side of that, not wanting to be this certain way, not wanting to be this depressed, angry person, this fearful person, this failure, this movement away. See, there's a process of movement that I want you to keep coming back to. We get so caught up in the sense, the thing we want trying to move away from, the thing we're trying to move toward, and we lose track of the quality of wanting itself, the process of wanting. It's shifting our attention from the nouns of life, the sense of I, the sense of it, that I want or don't want, to the process of it, like the verb of the quality of wanting. If you allow yourself to be more of a verb, things, the practice works much better. So also this wanting shows up in dependent origination. So dependent origination is a somewhat complex series of 12 steps that really describes how we form a sense of self. And wanting shows up as a very key part of that. Not to go into the details of it, but basically there's these kind of past conditions that come up from our history, our past actions, our upbringing, our cultural influences. All these qualities shape how we're predisposed to experience life. From that predisposition, you have a sense data. A sense point. You hear a sound, you hear a word, you see a person, you smell something. And from that point on, you start to lean toward it, you start to push away from it, depending if you like it or dislike it. From that point in, we start to become more and more coalesced, more condensed around that quality of wanting. That's the process of becoming, of giving birth to ourselves. So essentially we're being birthed and we're dying many times in a day. This kind of predisposition, like example I think of for myself, like my grandfather on my mom's side, was like to play chess. And so he taught all the grandsons how to play chess. There's no grand hunters in my family. So we all, you know, had this certain very positive association with playing chess, because there's this, you know, our grandfather who he loved and who loved us. And so whenever I hear that word chess, it's because of that past history. It's like I'm pre-programmed or preset to have a positive experience around that. Easily go into a sense of wanting that could last for a few moments, for a few hours, for a few days or months, So it has a very powerful trigger there. Same too with things which have a negative influence. You know, if we have a sense of criticism from, let's say, a father or a grandfather, for example. And so we start to become very sensitive. We feel ourselves being judged, being criticized. What's happening is we're pre-programmed to react in that certain way. So this is dependent origination, like there's this point of contact, right? Before that, there's all this past history that drives it. Big part of that is ignorance, delusion, our past history and actions. So once that moment happens, then from that point on, we tend to go into this sense of wanting. So this craving is such a key piece, a key link, because after that we go into birth, and after birth we go into death. So is birth such a bad thing? Is, you know, being born into a sense of identity, a sense of wanting, is that such a bad thing? I think it's a very important question to look at. Reflect on any time that you're feeling bad, that you're feeling upset, depressed, angry, an emotional state you just do not like, you've taken birth in that state. And, you know, thinking back to last week's talk about the election, I mean, how many people took birth in a certain state of mind? So when we take birth, there's a certain suffering that's inherent in that. If we take birth in some process that's very pleasant, that we really much enjoy, what happens when that ends? When that stops, which it inevitably will, then there's a quality of suffering that arises from that. So when there's birth arises, there's eventually going to be some type of suffering, some grief, some loss. And so this is a whole cycle from that suffering and loss and grief conditions our ignorance, which conditions our actions, which conditions our predisposition. So it's this cycle that goes over again and again. Understanding craving, understanding wanting, helps us start to really interrupt that cycle, to start to break it, to not be so driven by it. That's why the Buddha talked about the deathless. The deathless. So we really deeply understand the Dharma, there is this quality of not being rising up, taking shape in the moment in a particular way to each experience. We take shape in relationship to it, we have a quality of suffering with that. Now if we don't take shape in that in relationship to life, what happens? What happens instead? Sometimes that can seem so far out of our experience. But when there's a moment of simply connecting with experience without any kind of agenda, wanting to be a certain way, there's just a simple ease with this moment's experience. There's not a rising of birth, a rising of death. You're just connected. You're intimate with it. There's no sense of separation. And those moments are actually much more common than we give it credit for. We start to look at those, orient our attention to those moments, we see them throughout the day. We see a beautiful sunset, and they're just this stopping and just enjoying it. And you know it will fade. You know, just hearing a sound of a bird, just feeling a breath, making contact with a friend. These moments of contact without this quality of wanting. And so finally, the fourth place that I found that wanting shows up in the suttas is what's called the unwholesome roots. Now, unwholesome, in our society, we have a certain charge around that, you know, unwholesome, like that's a sense of, it brings up a little tension in myself when I hear that word. But these are really the fundamental patterns, forces that create suffering in our lives, greed, hatred and delusion, how they classically defined. Basically, you can think of delusion is not understanding how things are. Ignorance, delusion. You're not understanding that things are always in a state of flux, always in change, nothing is permanent. that there's not a lasting sense of self, that it does not change, that it's always in flux, always changing itself. And there's a certain unsatisfactoriness because of those two things. When we really see those, then delusion falls away, ignorance falls away. When we don't see that, then naturally our actions go out and toward wanting. If I don't see that things are changing or in flux, I try to find things, ways to make them stick. I try to push things away. So these four qualities seen in the suttas, of the hindrances, the Four Noble Truths, the dependent origination, and also these unwholesome roots. These are ways that this is the importance the Buddha placed on this pattern. In some ways, you can see this quality of wanting, this tendency to want, is one of, or perhaps you can argue, is the key thing to understand in this practice. It becomes really the fabric of who we are. Who Tim is, who you are, who self and other is based in this quality of wanting. And from that sense of defining who we are and others are, that's how our actions flow from. It's how we form ourselves, and it's how the whole world is interpreted, is experienced through our senses. Because we hear something, we interpret it through our own ignorance, our own patterns. So what are we supposed to do? What can we do about this? What can we do? Because we can say, okay, I really want to not want. Right? But that's just another subtle quality of wanting. And it's a pitfall that we often fall into as Dharma practitioners, is we hear the Dharma and we want to not want. We want to stay on the breath. We want to not be distracted. So we take the essence of the teachings and we, without realizing it, we apply our own old strategy of wanting. You know, how often do you sit and meditate and not evaluate it? You know, for a long time I was realizing I had this, almost this Dharma coach that said, okay, a little more focus on the beginning of the breath and okay, let go of that thought. It's kind of like always weighing in, kind of directing how I should be in that moment. Right? That sense of preference, a sense of direction. We have to start with that. You know, most of us have to have that quality of, okay, this is what we're doing, learning that. But we need to not stay there forever. If we're going to really deepen, really integrate and understand the deepest part of the Buddha's teaching. So it becomes very tricky. Because wanting becomes a closed loop. That anything that we identify as not okay, we shift into wanting it to go away. Anything that we want, we shift into wanting it. So it's like we're always kind of doing this back and forth. There's a famous picture by a Dutch artist, M.C. Esler, called Drawing Hands. So there's one hand drawing something, and you look, you follow it around, and it's another hand drawing the other hand. So it's like these two hands drawing themselves. Which one started? You know, they're both engaged in this process of creating the each other. And that's how wanting is. Wanting creates more wanting. So we have to shift out of the very assumptions of wanting. This wanting is really the spark that keeps things going, as we saw in dependent origination. Without wanting, things fall away. Without wanting, there's not origination of suffering. So how to do this? It's like often, okay, we try to work with wanting, and at first we're going to be really looking at it with this sense of preference, because that's what we learn, that's what we know. We pay attention. So it's a little bit like trying to bail out a boat with too much, sinking boat. We're taking buckets of water and throwing it. But we're throwing it over our shoulder into the back of the boat. Okay, so we're not making much progress. But it feels good to be doing something. And at least I'm doing something here. I'm going to save myself. Right? And we don't realize that we're just keeping the process going. So how do we step outside this process? It's not about willing ourselves not to want, even mindfulness of wanting isn't enough. That's an essential part, to be able to see it, to understand it, to really investigate it. But eventually there's a sense of needing to step completely outside of that paradigm. That picture of the hands drawing each other, you have to step outside of the very paper itself, the very logic itself. Because the Dharma asks us to do much more than simply observe life, to observe these patterns. There's this stepping out of it. And it's very paradoxical, because it's hard to, we can't really say how to do that. You have to create the conditions for allow that to arise. You know, sincere practice, ongoing practice, a sense of curiosity, a sense of interest. But it happens, it's of conditions that arise that allow it to finally happen. Kerry Peterson did a talk a few years ago on a series of Zen stories of nuns. So there's one I'm going to read to you called No Water, No Moon. When the nun Chiyono studied Zen under Buko of Ingaku, she was unable to attain the fruits of meditation for a long time. At last, one moonlight night, she was carrying water in an old pail bound with bamboo. The bamboo broke and the bottom fell out of the pail. And at that moment, Chiyono was set free. In commemoration, she wrote a poem. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail. Since the bamboo strip was weakened and was about to break, until at the last, the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail. No more moon in the water. And this poem, that sense of trying to keep putting together that bucket, to keeping it intact. This is wanting, acting on wanting. It's the self perpetuating the self. So we keep making that bucket stay intact, even though we realize it's starting to fall apart through our practice. And then finally, we shift our paradigm completely. And in that moment of shifting, things fall away. No more water in the pail. No more moon in the water. Now the paradox of this, it's like we have to have effort. There's another Zen story of this group of musicians, and they invited this person from another country to play this new flute. Okay, so this person, they had a gathering of musicians, and so this person came and played the flute at the very end. And after they played, it was complete silence, because it was unearthly, it was godlike. And so finally, one old person said, like a god, you know, the highest compliment. So the group of musicians said, let's learn how to play this instrument. Let's take our promising student and send them to be a student of this master. So they gathered the money together, took this person out, and so the person followed this master, and the master gave them a piece to work on. So he practiced very diligently. He knew he had mastered it. And he went to play to the master. And the master said, something missing. So he went back, doubled his effort, worked even harder. So he knew he was technically perfect. And still, something missing. This went on for 6 months. Okay, so this is a very accomplished musician. Just not being able to get the endorsement from this master. You know, incredibly frustrating. This mirrors our own practice. We come back to our breath again and again, even if it feels like nothing's happening, nothing's working, but something is happening. So finally, the student was so frustrated he gave up and left in the dead of night and wandered homeless, because he couldn't go back to his village because he had squandered all their money, couldn't come back with any kind of certificate from the master. And finally, years later, he was wandered back to his old village. And the musicians were having another gathering and invited him to come back. So the past is forgotten. Please come. So he came and he happened to bring the flute that he was trying to learn. And he was in tatters. He had nothing left to lose. No ego was washed away. And he played And at the end, complete silence. And finally, someone said, like a god. So that's the paradox, is that we want our practice to deepen, our want it to work. And we have to want it to work. We have to apply our effort. But at some point, that vehicle has to fall away. That bucket has to fall, has to collapse. Often, when we talk about it in this way, there's a sense of releasing wanting. There's an argument that comes up in the mind. Without wanting, how am I supposed to plan? How am I supposed to accomplish anything? What about retirement? What about overthrowing this injustice, fixing this and that, wanting to make a difference? What about wanting good things? The ability to act in the world doesn't go away. It does not go away. It's actually enhanced. It's transformed and enhanced. But it does ask us to give up something very fundamental, this belief in wanting, this belief in who we are, that we have to take shape, that we have to have this bucket. The sense of wanting is the fabric of our lives, so we have to be willing to give up that fabric. So how do we do this? So reflecting on this, you know, three things that have been helpful for me, and I see it in students, is one, there has to be a certain level of concentration, a certain level of steadiness of attention. I mean, Christina Feldman has often said that this quality of concentration or steadiness of samadhi is one of our Achilles' heels, you know, for most people, that we don't practice enough to have that steadiness. So, you know, practicing a few times a week for 10 minutes isn't enough to cultivate that steadiness. It really does take a sincere daily practice, you know, of a certain, you know, 40 minutes or so to start to cultivate that. Going on retreats is a great way to cultivate this steadiness of attention, if our lives allow that, if our minds allow us to go on retreats. But that's not the only way to get concentration. Concentration also comes when there's intense interest in something, when there's intense curiosity that arises. Think, if you've ever been around a newborn baby, how hard is it to pay attention? It's like it's just there. There's just a silence that comes. You know, when you hear someone has a terminal illness, how hard is it to be present with that person? There's times when our interest just naturally stabilizes our concentration, our steadiness of mind. There's no wavering. There's no inkling of shifting. It's just there. So finding that quality of interest can be a profound way to develop concentration. Concentration also arises as this process of purification. And as we're sitting on our cushion and coming back to our breath again and again, we're releasing objects of wanting, of movement toward and away. As we do that, something starts to purify in our consciousness. As insights arise, that's also a quality of purification. We're moving more toward wisdom and away from ignorance. As we become more based in wisdom and compassion, naturally our minds are more settled. Naturally our attention is more steady. So it becomes less and less effortful to pay attention, to have this steadiness of attention. Becomes more the default state of the mind. Concentration also, choosing how we use our lives, how we use our attention. If we spend a lot of time with unethical behavior, we churn up a lot of stuff. It's hard to be very steady with that. That's why ethics are such a foundation of the Buddhist teaching. In a sense of how much do we allow ourselves to be just so distracted by those advertisements, by smartphones, by the internet. All those qualities have a sense of destabilization, or a lack of settledness of our minds. So concentration. The next one is intention. intention or aim. Because often people have a lot of concentration, but still the practice doesn't deepen because their intention isn't so clear. Where are they actually, why are they practicing? Where are they aiming their practice? Why are they practicing? So something like wanting can be a beautiful thing to say, okay, how can I really understand that? How can I understand this quality of wanting? And for myself, understanding the sense of self was often a very big, really a driving force in my practice, the sense of wanting to understand. See how we're using the same word wanting, but it's from the heart's desire. It's kind of free of the craving, free of suffering. It's really the sense of deep interest. You know, how is this bucket still put together? You know, aiming of our practice. How do I want to, where do I want to bring my attention to? Not only formal practice, but during our life. Start to notice that leaning into the moment, that pushing away from the moment. Become curious about it. How do I want to use my energy? How do I want to use my finite life? And so the final quality is sincerity. So this is a deep sense of honesty. This willingness to see yourself unflinchingly, to see all the parts that shift into a little bit of wanting, of not wanting, to see that, to be so so attuned to that, no matter where it shows up, that you want to know it, you want to see it, you want to experience it. Because the sincerity is, because we are swimming against the stream. The stream wants to go this certain direction. We have to have these deep qualities of concentration, of intention, of sincerity. Because each one of us comes in with a certain spark. You know, so the teachings, practice, it's really up to each one of us how much that flame grows. And this quality of sincerity is a big part of that. Because we have to be willing to have let our buckets collapse. To let the bucket fall apart. We have to be willing to give up this fabric, something that we've hungered our whole life for. It's really this, you know, wanting is a fabric of our lives. To be able to release that, to give it up, is asking a lot. And so the sincerity, like, is that really what I want? Is that something I'm ready for? And there's a timing of that, that may arise already in you, may arise in the future. So just to finish, the sense of wanting, ultimately it's simply about not seeing the perfection of the moment, not seeing how the moment can't be anything other than it is. There's a deep sufficiency in the moment if we simply open our eyes and release wanting. As William Blake said in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is, infinite. For we have closed ourselves up till we see all things through narrow chinks of our cavern. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to us as it is, infinite. We're perceiving life as that way. What is there to want? Okay, this is quietly, sit quietly for a moment or two. Thank you. So we have some time for comments or questions, reflections. Yes.
How do you suggest to work
Right. So the question is about, you know, grief and the pain associated with it, you know, the opposite of wanting. And is there a way to work with that? Because obviously it's so painful that we want to get rid of it. We don't want to suffer, but is there a way if we can work with it? Is that, yeah. So grief, you know, one part I didn't bring out in this talk is that we have to really meet ourselves where we are. So when we've lost something, when we're really grieving something, whether it's a loss of a person, loss of an identity, loss of a hope for the future, wherever that grief may show up, is that learning to tend to that in a very skillful way can be very helpful. Because if we're trying to jump over that, you know, the worst case, I don't know if it's the worst case, but spiritual bypassing is we want to get over it. I'm a good meditator, everything's impermanent. Okay, that's just how life it is. It is as it is, you know, that kind of a thing. But we're skipping over the real pain that's there. Right? So by learning to tend to grief in a very, very compassionate way, a very gentle way, can allow it to soften. Because that grief itself, it's actually, if you look at the dependent origination, grief is the end of birth, right? It's the end part of birth. And Ajahn Chah said, when someone was grieving a loss of someone, he said that, you know, if you want to grieve when someone is born, not when they died. You know, that's kind of extreme, but that's, you kind of get the spirit of that too. Okay, so, but when someone has died, you know, if we really open to that grief and really feel it, there's a way it starts to interrupt the ignorance. It starts to interrupt the pattern of becoming in the future. You know, I talked about grief around the election a couple of weeks ago, actually using the grief process as an important template for addressing that. So looking at how we have the sense of denial, the sense of bargaining, a sense of fighting with it, being angry about it, fearful around it, a sense of sadness and acceptance. All those five stages are essential for us to really open to. You weren't here last couple weeks. So an analogy I used is like when I was younger, I went through a divorce. Okay, and so that was at that time in my life, was the most traumatic thing, the most devastating thing I've ever experienced, because it wasn't what I was expecting. But to work with that grief, I actually made like a CD or a tape, I think, back then, of all the songs that triggered different parts of that grief, that I felt the anger come up. I felt the sadness. I felt the betrayal. I felt the fear. And I just kept playing that over and over again, giving myself permission to feel it, to let it flow out, the tears to flow out, the anger to flow out. And just did that over 6 months, over a year, till finally, okay, I can hear the song without that coming up. It's like an analogy I used is having a soil, like a field that you're trying to till, and has all these rocks in it. The rocks are the unresolved, unfelt emotions of grief. So you till it, take the rocks out, the next year more rocks come out from the frost. Then you go back and you pick those rocks out again. So there's this patience of going back again and again. And that way it starts to move through those patterns of anger, of fear, of denial, of bargaining, to finally acceptance starts to rise. And in that way, then we start to be able to live much more present, much more connected to the present moment. So wanting, it's like the paradox, like we have to really attend to what's arising in our experience skillfully. If we jump over to not wanting it, it just comes out later. When we really attend to it, then there's a much deeper letting go. Yes, Krista.
I practice
Sure. So the comment question is about just grief around the election and that sense of, you know, being, you know, in some ways happy that she cared enough to grieve, that she cared enough about the world to feel the deep sadness, the sense of wanting things to be a certain way, the, you know, the deep disappointment, the deep grieving with that. I think sometimes we have this misperception of what it means to be awakened, you know, and how that will show up in relationship to loss. So we think of like the Buddha. We think, okay, you know, he was enlightened. If he wasn't enlightened, who was? You know, there's that sense of attainment. So how was he with loss? You know, do we imagine that he would just like, oh, you know, that just, my best friend dying is just like a leaf falling from the tree. You know, there's, when his two chief disciples died, he said, it felt like the light had gone out of the world. You know, so it affected him. It's like caring does affect us. So if we think of ourselves as being this allowing ourselves to be this fluid being, yeah, there's this movement into life, wanting it to be a certain way, and it doesn't change that way. So we feel the grief of that. But how fluid do we stay with it? And we start to hunker down, become tighter and tighter around it, you know, we're going the wrong way. But if we're feeling the grief flowing through us, we're feeling that desire and that wanting, and allowing that to flow into actions, you know, that's dancing the dance of life. So I think it's really that sense of hardness, of contraction, versus the sense of fluidity. I think that's an important piece. The same thing with the caring, yeah.
I think that's the part of
the caring, not craving. Yes, yeah, how does the caring not become craving? Yeah, so how does craving not become, or caring not become craving? You know, the more attached we are to a certain outcome, the more craving there was inherent in it. If there's a sense of, you know, I really would like, I prefer to go this way, I prefer this outcome. But when it doesn't go that way, and it's the more devastated we are, the more craving we were with that. And so it's, I would shift it to less of like how I should be, or I mean, it doesn't sound like you're doing that, but how I should be or shouldn't be, but really just understanding that. Seeing it as a process, like, oh, I really cared about this, and I really am suffering around it. Because it's not the way I want. And that sense of carrying into the future, into the world. You know, like how can I have that full-hearted engagement, but at the same time releasing the outcome? Yeah, that's the trick. Can you really engage with something? Can you really show up? Can you give a gift to someone, and you know, if they don't give you a thank you card or just acknowledge it, can there still be that sense? You know, I did the best I could. I really, my intention was aligned behind it. So practice that in small ways. You know, you go up into a grocery store and you really connect with the cash or the checkout person, and they're in a grumpy mood and just still don't make any eye contact. You know, what do they do with this precious gift? What do you do with the fact that that wasn't received? You know, does it change the fact that you had the intention to give it? Yes, Ashi.
I have trouble with reconciling not wanting, but at the same time, you know, wanting to do something, you know, wanting to, like you said, save the time. So, you know, I guess there's a sense of beauty that sort of thing that we have to do.
Yeah, so how to reconcile this sense of not wanting with a sense of stewardship, of taking care of like the environment, for example, that sense of kind of higher duty or responsibility as a caring human being. Is that?
Yeah, it's
So in sports, the sense of the person who won is the one who wanted it more. Yeah. So like if we don't want it, we can't achieve the goal of environmental health or that kind of a thing. Is that? Yeah. So it's coming back to that's really stepping outside this fabric. It doesn't make any sense because we're thinking we're the hand drawing the hand, right? Which hand started it? Which hand will stop? They're both part of the same process. So this kind of closed loop of logic. Okay? The key piece of that logic is that wanting creates this separate sense of self, this separate sense of identity. Some of the clues of that are like wanting a certain outcome, you know, wanting things to be a certain way. You know, you often feel the friction of it when that sense of self is challenged. When someone else, you think, okay, I'm speaking well, and someone says, you know, you were boring. You know, then that sense of self like goes, whoa. So you can see that. you can see it by contrast, right? When that is really seen and dropped away, then the actions come not out of wanting or craving, but of a much different way. A different mechanism is involved. And I would actually say that they're much more effective in that way. Okay, because if I have a certain agenda, like I want things to be a certain way, and there's this tightness around it, you can feel it in your body. There's a tightness in the body that shows up if you look. You come across the people who don't want what you want, right? How well can you meet that tightness? Because your tightness meets their tightness. Your sense of self meets their sense of self. If you're not coming from a sense of contracted self, but with this deep intentionality, you can connect and say, oh, this person has this perspective. I can connect with that perspective. And you can actually work together to achieve what you want. But it's not you wanting it. Yeah, it's really stepping outside our normal way of viewing things. But it doesn't take away any ability to act. It actually enhances it. Yeah. Yes, yeah, that's a good comment, is that when that wanting really gets purified, so it's really the heart's desire, we can actually come in much more contact with really what we really want, what our deeper intentions are. Because so often our wants are kind of mixed. If we really look honestly at them, there's a sense of, you know, I want the environment to do well. I want, you know, things for the future generations. But, you know, I would also like to be recognized for my efforts. You know, there's that little bit of thing. Or like, you know, I want that person to realize how bad they are for not wanting that. You know, but there's this pure-hearted, when we really align with it, we don't care, you know, what forces come up. Someone else can take all the credit for our years of work, and we're happy that that's going forth. And so there's this deeper alignment, both recognition with our intention, but also deeper alignment, capacity to align with it. We're coming from wanting, that sense of separation. Remember, it's closing us down. It's constructed in a certain way. We can't really connect with how life is unfolding. And there's still the direction that we're moving, but we're moving in it with a much more fluid way. All right, we should go on to announcements. So thank you for your sincerity.